For each of the talks, I'm going to begin with a sample of really, really beautiful liturgy. We all know intimate liturgy. We're going to be having it with the sisters all this weekend, smaller liturgies. We've probably experienced parish liturgies all the time. I'm going to offer you a few examples of really, really just kind of beautiful and extraordinary liturgy so we can see these two maybe liturgies that not all of us are accustomed to all the time. The first one is a very American liturgy, and it comes from sort of the flagship church of the United States, the National Shrine of the Immaculate Conception, which is right across the street from me in Washington, D.C. I help out there. I'm a member of the liturgical committee for the National Shrine, and I'm also one of the confessors there and a frequent preacher. So I give you all, this is the entrance, all we're going to do is the entrance procession of the Mass, the Easter Mass from not this past year, but the year before, 2013.
So here we go. Are you ready?
That's a processional cross, huh? The cross requires a really, really stout server, strong server to carry it in because it's so heavy. And the boys at Catholic U really vied to be the servers there. There's a really great core of servers. You might recognize Callista Gingrich right here, wife of Newt Gingrich, who sings in the Basilica Choir. There's Cardinal Wuerl, who's the Cardinal Archbishop of Washington there at the end. He's the main celebrant of the Mass. Now this incenser that they're going to bring him called a thurible is an incredibly huge and heavy thurible because it has to fill that big, huge shrine. It can hold 12 charcoals. A normal thurible, if you pack it, will hold 3. This one holds 12. So it's, you open it up and you basically take a small shovel and dump incense into it. And it really gets a lot of smoke going. It's a really cool thing. See the smoke? Oh. That's the TV guy.
That's the
That's the cantor. She's over on the side here. My friend Susie Kavinsky. EWTN has a feed from the Basilica mics, and so they don't have a mic on the congregation. So they just have her mic. They've put the choir in, too. If you see the choir standing behind the altar over there. There's Susie right there. That paschal candle, the deacon has to lug in. Just, it's a huge thing. And then you see this is still going. The procession's still going. So now the organist is having to make this up. This is all just out of his head. On spur of the moment. Yeah. Improvisation.
Oh.
And he's watching on his TV camera. He's way up in the organ gallery. He's watching in the little television screen of this. And you know he's got to end right when the guy comes right over here. Right here. See? So that procession in 10 minutes or so, you know, that's what the liturgy in these big churches are about. And this kind of liturgy really can be phenomenal. It can be really blow somebody away, and it can even lead to conversion. My dad came from a family of Protestants, and sort of frontier Protestants, no denomination. They had the Bible, they had Jesus, and they knew that. And they would sometimes go to different churches that suited them, sometimes not. And some of these churches always had singing and a sermon, and once a month maybe they would pass around crackers and grape juice at the end for communion. And that was their liturgy. There was no liturgy as such, no sort of pre-programmed stuff. And when my dad was about 16 years old, he went with a friend of his to the Episcopal Cathedral in Fresno. And there he saw a liturgy for the first time. He saw it in English. And it was filled with glorious music and a beautiful, beautiful liturgy. Everybody took part, and there seemed to be a lot of order. And my dad was converted on the spot. And he said this is what he thought church should be like. I mean, it was just absolutely beautiful. There was a lot of order. There was glory to it. He didn't understand what it was all about, but it just moved him, the great beauty. Father Robert Barron, great evangelist and priest of our time, has said, one of the first thresholds of evangelization is beauty. And so for my dad, 16-year-old kid in the mid-50s, walking into this Episcopal cathedral, not even a Catholic church, but sort of a Catholic-like liturgy, and was converted on the spot. Now, my dad became a Catholic many, many years later. And one of the hardest things for him to do when he left the Episcopal church was he saw in the Episcopal Church, at least historically, and the diocese he was in, the Episcopal diocese, there was a great care for the liturgy, a great care for the liturgy. And even though it was a country diocese, there'd be a church of maybe 40 or 50 people that took a lot of interest in the liturgy, making sure the liturgy was beautiful and done well every Sunday. And he saw the local Catholic church where maybe, you know, 1,000 people would go on Sunday, but the liturgy was done pretty poorly. The priest would sort of walk in, it would be bad music, the priest would sort of read through the Mass, not a lot of, you know, enthusiasm, the people didn't respond very well, and it was hard for him because many people, when they convert to the Catholic Church, they convert from what we call a lower liturgical tradition, right? Again, from the crackers and grape juice and maybe, you know, a sermon and some music, some hymns, to a higher liturgical tradition with Catholics. But my dad, coming from the Anglican tradition, was coming from a glorious tradition, at least historically, and looking at what he saw was kind of a lower tradition. And so one of the hardest sort of last barriers for him of becoming a Catholic was, how can I give up something so beautiful for something that's kind of more pedestrian? But eventually he realized that truth was very important, and he had to swim the Tiber. And then he became a Catholic in the beginning of the Jubilee year of 2000, so Advent 1, 1999. And one of the gifts that we arranged for Dad was that I was at Notre Dame at the time as an organ. It was before I entered the Dominicans, and was one of the graduate assistants in organ at the Basilica of the Sacred Heart there, one of the organists at the Basilica on campus. And so, and that year that after Dad became Catholic, we brought him to Notre Dame for the Triduum, for the great, you know, liturgies of Easter. And so he experienced liturgy, which is a lot like this liturgy that you just saw here at the Basilica of the National Shrine. Brass, big choir, big church, beautiful music. And my dad, I think at that point, knew it was safe to be a Catholic. Then, you know, what he had done was fine. His first Catholic, you know, Easter as a Catholic, was able to go to confession at the Basilica and then experience the Catholic Church's liturgy in all of its glory. My dad really became to love the Catholic liturgy and strove in his own local parish to work and strive to make the liturgy as beautiful as possible. And he did that until the day of his death. Now, today, we often fight, especially in your parishes, you may have experienced this. Oftentimes, wars are fought over liturgy. People get upset about the liturgy. The wars are a lot less than they used to be. They used to be really big back in the 90s. They still are going on in many places. You've heard, though, the old joke, right? What's the difference between a liturgist and a terrorist? You've all heard this joke?
No.
You can negotiate with the terrorist. Right? One of the things that we do often at boy Dominican houses, the male houses of studies especially, is we tend to fight a lot about the liturgy, especially the younger Dominicans tending to want a more traditional liturgy, wanting more chant, more polyphony, and really always kind of pushing for that. And so why all this argument about the liturgy? It even goes further. There's an instruction manual for the liturgy. Does anybody know what it's called for the Mass? Yeah. It's called the what? The GERM, yeah, which stands for General Instruction of the Roman Missal. One of my brothers, because when we're fighting over things, the GERM is always quoted, right? And so you talk about it as germ warfare. Sorry, bad jokes. My own interactions as a college freshman, when I was at Santa Clara University as a freshman, I come from, like I said, a very traditional part of California. And my mom's parish, the Catholic parish, was a mixture of sort of different cultures. And it was a farming parish. They were dairymen and people who worked in the fields. And in the 1930s and 40s, they had a young pastor at this church who thought it was important that his congregation learn chant. So this is back before the council. And he taught these dairymen how to sing a couple of the very most simple settings of the Latin Mass. Well, after the Vatican Council, there were still times where we would have these big sort of parish liturgies where the Spanish community would be there, the English community, the Portuguese community. And so to make things easy, they just continued to sing this setting of the Latin Mass. And it was kind of, so I learned that as a kid, right? On the major feast days, you would sing this Latin Mass, and I learned Mass of the Angels. As a little kid, you know, you don't learn this is hard, right? You just memorize it. So as a little kid, I memorized it. And I got to college and was suggested maybe we do some Latin chant. And I was told, this is in the mid-90s, by the college campus ministry, oh no, that's absolutely forbidden to do. So it's forbidden? What do you mean? I said, yes, Vatican II forbade Latin Gregorian chant. Sorry, sisters, for the Mass we just did. And I said, well, wait a minute. I said, we did this all growing up. What do you mean the Vatican II? We had a Vatican II parish. I mean, the liturgy was in English. The altar faced this way. You know what I thought was Vatican II. And they said, oh, no. Your parish just hasn't caught up with Vatican II yet. The reforms have not been implemented. I thought, ooh, I didn't. So I called up my mom and I said, Mom, they're telling me that this is forbidden and it's by Vatican II. My mom, smart woman, said, have you ever read Vatican II? And I said, no. And she said, well, why don't you start doing it? And so that's when I began to read these documents, was as a freshman in college. And I started to realize that actually Vatican II said something quite the opposite. Vatican II said all people should learn chant, not just the choir, just all the whole people of God deserve to learn these things. And so people should be encouraged to learn it if they can. And maybe even the most simple chants can be taught to entire congregations. And maybe some Latin, and so I thought, oh my, this is the exact opposite of what I was told. And I remember taking the documents to our liturgy people at college and saying, actually, so I read Vatican II, and what you were saying, it's actually the opposite. And then I said, whoa. You're talking about the letter of Vatican II. We're speaking about the spirit of Vatican II. And so I said, wait a minute, are you talking about, I said, I don't understand this. How can the letter be the opposite of this, what the spirit is? And so then I kept reading, and I thought, well, I'll read some commentaries on Vatican II. And I read a commentary on church music by a man named Joseph Ratzinger. And so I brought it to them, and again, they said, well, this man's never going to go anywhere, so don't trust me. Strange times. But the point being, I read the documents. And one of the things that Vatican II encouraged was for all the people to read the documents. This just not should be something that somebody's spoon-feeding, you know, and so that we would listen to some sort of ideology, but that we would actually be receiving what the church says. And be receiving what the church says and try to implement it at our local level, however that's possible, instead of just sort of taking it at some sort of workshop. And so what I'm going to present to you this weekend is something right from the documents of the church. This General Instruction of the Roman Missal, which you could Google, G-I-R-M, and you will find the General Instruction online. You can read it. It's a public document. This is not secret knowledge. We need to read the documents. They're there for everyone, not just the clergy, and that's part of what we're going to do this weekend. As Dominicans, like I said at the beginning of the talk, we are formed by the liturgy. We are formed by the sacred liturgy. And it is the liturgy, both the Mass and the liturgy of the hours, that we help, in addition to our study, our community and our apostolate to give the fruits of our preaching to others, to go and evangelize the world. Now, if we're formed by the liturgy, we realize that there's a problem in many Catholic liturgies. I see this on Sunday. Many Catholics still go to Mass in a pious coma, right? They still go to Mass in a pious coma. They're there at Mass, but maybe they're not understanding it, or they're not getting stuff out of it. You know, they're there, and they say, oh, it's beautiful. I go there, and I'm just kind of quiet. And you can see them there. They're not responding. They're not singing. Or maybe they're responding, but they don't know what it is. I remember when my cousin was getting married, and we were going through the wedding Mass, and I said, okay, and I'm trying to get through the different parts of the liturgy, and I said, there's no creed at a wedding Mass. And my cousin was marrying a non-Catholic, and she said, what's the creed? And he said, don't you remember when we would go to Mass, and like we sit there for a long time, and it's like really boring, and the priest is talking, and like nobody's listening? And then afterwards, we stand up, and everybody kind of goes, I said, oh yeah, I remember this. That's the creed. I was like, oh. So what I'm trying to do tonight, and what I'll try to be doing the next couple of conferences, is to really explain. This might be really basic for some of you. Might know all of this, and so it might be review. I'm sorry if it's review. But for I found that sometimes even the most basic stuff, including like what the vestments mean, what the readings are, how the readings are organized, the different parts of the Mass, where does this come from? Where does this prayer, what language is this prayer even in? That these are things that need to have some explanation. I'm doing it not only to give an academic exercise, like I said, but also to help us develop our personal life of holiness so that when we go to Mass, we can more fully participate because we can understand what these things mean at all sorts of different levels. And not only that, that we grow in our personal holiness, but we can give the fruits of that holiness to others, to evangelize others. So when people are talking about this, we can actually explain this stuff to them too. It's really important, brothers and sisters, because a lot of lay people just don't have access to a priest to ask them, what does this stuff mean? And so if we have an educated and well-formed laity, then we can help form others, which is what Dominican laity, I think, should be doing, right? We should be sort of on the forefront of this in terms of evangelization, of forming others. And so hopefully we can get some good formation this weekend in terms of understanding the liturgy by listening, by observing, and also by participating, right? Good. So, end of first part of the talk. First part and the second part, I want to talk about what liturgy is not and what it is. And the third part, I don't know if we're going to get to it tonight, a brief history of reforms of the liturgy. And then tomorrow we'll start talking about the liturgy as such. We'll go through it piece by piece. Okay? First of all, what the liturgy is not. The liturgy is not. The liturgy is not mere play acting. We're not just going through a play. We're not just reenacting in like some sort of a Christmas pageant or something like that. I want to make this very clear. It's not. We're just not trying to recreate the Last Supper. Despite what people might think is cute, the central focus of the Christmas liturgy is not the pageant that happens. And when do we put baby Jesus in the manger? Even though that's what a lot of, you know, attention is focused on, right? The most beautiful, the most packed masses of all of our churches are always those Christmas Eve masses where they have the pageant, right? Midnight Mass is usually pleasantly full, and the masses on Christmas Day, only the faithful hardcore are there. But they have some of the richest liturgical texts, and they have some of the religious liturgical masses, and it's important to pay attention to this. So it's not just about recreating the birth of baby Jesus 2,000 years ago. It's about bringing Jesus present now. We'll get to that in a second. Palm Sunday is not just a play to recreate the entrance of Christ into Jerusalem. I heard once about some innovative liturgical people who had the priest ride in on a donkey. That would be dumb, right? Because we're not just play acting. We do a procession, so there is some sort of mimetic piety. There is some sort of recreation, but it's not merely a play. Likewise, Good Friday's liturgy is not a mere passion play, not merely a movie to recreate what Jesus the crucifixion. The Mass, every time we celebrate Mass, is not a playtime that tries to recreate Holy Thursday. Now, we got a problem with this because I think people often try to say, what would Jesus, I hear this a lot with criticism, what would Jesus have done at the Last Supper? Well, I tell people, we don't have a DVD of the Last Supper, right? Not only that, but Jesus did not have a Roman missal at the Last Supper. He gave us a general idea of what we're supposed to do, and the liturgy has developed from there. Also, we might have a false even impression. We have to be very careful even when we're doing the history about thinking, what might Jesus have done? Everybody here has seen the movie Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade about the Holy Grail, search for the Holy Grail. Okay, so you remember the very last scene of this movie? This is a movie from my childhood, that they go into a room and there's a bunch of cups, right? A bunch of cups around. Many of them are gold cups and ruby. And the Nazi goes and he gets the fanciest cup and he goes and drinks from it and dies, right? And you're supposed to, if you drink from the true cup, you will not die. Then Indiana Jones, does anybody remember what he says? He says something here that's actually, there's a problem with what he says, but what does he say? Do you remember? It should be a simple carpenter's cup, right? And then he grabs a clay vessel that has like a little gold paint on the inside, drinks from it. That's the real one. What's the problem with that? Okay, but he didn't have the general instruction. Jesus didn't have that. But what's the problem with his statement? It should be a simple cup of a carpenter.
Yeah, there's no gold
inside. No, but what was problematic with that statement, though? Was Jesus having a meal, a simple carpenter's meal?
No,
what was he actually doing? The Passover meal. Oh, so shouldn't we then go back and look, what did a first century Passover meal look like? Archaeologists have done this, by the way, and guess what they've started to find? Very special metal ceremonial cups that were used for the first century Passover meals. So we don't know exactly what Jesus used. He might have used a clay, he might have been poor and not been able to afford a fancy Passover cup. But the point being is that you can't just make simple assumptions. We can't make simple assumptions and go this kind of Indiana Jones theology saying, oh yeah, you know, he was a carpenter, therefore it's going to be a simple cup. Well, not exactly. It was a Passover meal. Those were not simple meals. Those were ritual meals. What did it look like? Again, we don't have the DVD. So it's important that we don't make sort of rash distinctions about these things. Again, so the big point is we're not trying to recreate details of the Last Supper, not even linguistic details. It's much more profound than this. It's something that Jesus gave us as a general principle, the general things to do, the command, do this in memory of me. By the way, what does that mean, memory? This is important to understanding Eucharistic theology, because a lot of people get this wrong. I had a friend of mine she left the Catholic Church and became an evangelical and wrote me a really angry email one day and said, Jesus says, do this in memory of me. I said, I know that. And then I said, what does that mean? The Greek word for that is anamnesis. Anamnesis means to make present, right? The memory, the idea of, and oh, this is coming from Jewish, the idea of Jewish memory. Jewish memory makes present the reality. So this is not some sort of dead memorial. This is not just sort of me thinking about something that happened 2,000 years ago. It's something that's made present here and now today. This goes to what liturgy is. Liturgy is. The liturgy of the Mass brings into time the one and exclusive and singular sacrifice of Christ on the cross on Mount Calvary. And it brings that into time. The sacrifice only happened once. We don't re-sacrifice Christ every time we have Mass. It's that one sacrifice that happened 2,000 years ago, but it is brought now, miraculously, into time, every time we have the Eucharist. So it does recall the past, but it's not only the past. It also looks to the future. It looks to heaven and to the end times, when we believe that we will have complete worship. We will see God face to face, not sacramentally, but see him profoundly face to face. We read this in the book of Revelation, right? About the altar and the lamb, which have been sacrificed on the altar. Scott Hahn, the great convert from evangelical Protestantism to the Catholic Church, talks about when he, after reading the book of Revelation, and then all of a sudden walking into a Catholic church and saying, oh, that's Revelation on the altar. He understood it, that this is the end times that we're celebrating. He wanted to say, yell at the Catholics, don't you know what you're doing? This is all biblical. Yeah, no kidding, right? So it is the past, it's the future, and it's also now. Now, sisters, you all say before the beginning of office, you say the O Sacrum Convivium, correct? You say the O Sacred Banquet. This is a very important prayer. It was composed by our brother, our Dominican brother, St. Thomas Aquinas, 800 years ago. And this prayer, this very short prayer, memorize it, because it will get you through any comps on the liturgy. It will also get you through any exam, and it will also give you, in a nutshell, what Eucharistic theology is. O sacred banquet, in which Christ becomes our food. And now we go into it. The memory of his passion is recalled, right? So we think of his passion. The soul, right now, is filled with grace, and a pledge of future glory is given to us. So all those things touch at Mass. Time and eternity touch. What happens now touches with before and after and all time, which is really, really profound when you think about it. As a Muslim friend of one of our brothers said to him, he said, if I believe what you Catholics claim to believe about the Eucharist, he said, I would come to church every day on my knees realizing what you claim that's going on. And the profound thing is, of course, this happens on every altar, in every place, throughout the world, until the end of time. This one sacrifice of Christ at all time is recreated every time the Mass is celebrated. It is instituted by Christ at the Last Supper, and it will exist until the Lord comes again. From the most ancient sacramentary and prayers about the Mass, we have a prayer which says, whenever the memorial of this sacrifice is celebrated, the work of redemption is accomplished. The work of redemption is accomplished every time this memorial is celebrated. It's one of the main reasons why a priest should celebrate Mass every single day, because that is the work of redemption that is accomplished in that. That the sacrifice of Christ is brought into time, and that work is perpetuated now on behalf of the church here in the world, on behalf of the church in purgatory, and hoping to get to the church in heaven. It is the whole thing together. My mom is real big on this when she talks to other priests. She said, you have two jobs. She said, your job is to read out of that book, the Liturgy of the Hours, and your other job is to celebrate Mass. And you need to do that every day because I can't celebrate Mass. You need to do that, Father. It's a good thing. The liturgy also reflects what we believe. There's an old saying, and actually it's a little bit, it's from St. Prosper of Aquitaine, which says, lex orandi, lex credendi. The law that we pray is the law that we believe. So if we know the liturgy, we will also know our belief, because what we pray is what we believe. That's why words matter. That's why these translations that we agonized about and fought over matter so much, because the words that we put into people's mouths are the things that form our law of belief. That's why it's very important to do that. Pope Paul VI went through great lengths in the Liturgy of Vatican II to say that this current liturgy that we celebrate represents the same tradition and therefore what we call hermeneutics of continuity, right? Pope Benedict XVI was really big on this, that it forms a continuity with the past. So the liturgy is not some sort of break of the past. It's not something that we have a new Mass. It's the same Mass. I say the revised liturgy or something like that. I never say the new Mass and the old Mass, because it's not like one was and another one is brand new. It's the same Mass of all time. The Mass comes out of the heritage of Jewish worship. And remember, what are the two places that the ancient Jews worshipped? The temple and the synagogue. And so we have both of that in the Mass. In the synagogue was primarily the service where the Torah was read and where the scriptures were explained. We can read that in the Gospels, right? Christ would go into the synagogues, he would read from the Torah, from the sacred books, from the prophets, and then he would preach. So that's the synagogue part, right? Liturgy of the Word corresponds to that. And then the temple liturgy, which was the sacrificial liturgy, where the priest would wear special vestments, set apart from the world, and go forth to offer sacrifice. Also in the temple was a place where God was praised. The psalms would be sung in the temple. The church does both of that in the sacred liturgy, the notion of sacrifice as well as the liturgy of the word. Liturgy is eternal. Like we talked about, that there are parts that Jesus gave us that we still use today that will never change. Example, the use of bread and wine. Can I consecrate a rice cracker?
No.
No. Can I consecrate oat bread?
No.
No. What does the bread have to be made out of?
Wheat.
Why? Because Jesus, yeah, the Lord used that, because that's the material he used. Can I consecrate sake? Can I consecrate apple wine? It has to be made of grapes, because that's what Jesus used. Yeah, there's a logic to this, through the sacraments, that actually continues all the way through. The use of bread and wine must happen. You can't have Mass without them. By the way, this is a big problem when there's a persecution. Especially if you're in a place that doesn't grow grapes. If you ever read a book called With God in Russia, My gosh, you won't put, make sure that you don't pick it up, especially if you're a guy. Don't pick up this book unless you have like 3 days to like just like read, because you'll just be like, it's about a Jesuit who gets trapped in Russia, an American Jesuit, and he gets sent to prison and he's there for years and years, and about how he survived. It's an amazing story. I recommend it for every guy, but every person should read this too. Brother Chizik, yeah, Walter Chizik. And he can't celebrate Mass because he doesn't have wine. And so what he does, whenever he can get a hold of a raisin, he keeps the raisin. And they ferment the raisins, and he's able to make just enough wine that he's able to secretly celebrate Mass. It's a really phenomenal story. So we need bread and wine. Priests in prison, too. That's a big thing to smuggle, if you're able to smuggle in wine somehow to a priest in prison so you can celebrate Mass. The Scriptures have always been proclaimed. If we read in the Acts of the Apostles, it says, the apostles joined together in the fellowship, the breaking of the bread, and the prayers. The Scriptures have always been part of that. The prayers of the faithful have always been lifted up in the Mass, that the prayers are all joined together. And the presence of the priest has always been needed. The apostles have always been there, and the presence of a priest has always been needed. So those things are kind of always the same. And if, in fact, if we read documents of the most ancient liturgies, they look a lot like, I mean, you can see the liturgy of today. But liturgy also develops. It also develops. There's sometimes a propaganda out there amongst the most traditional of our brothers and sisters who say, we had one Mass that existed for 1,500 years, and then it broke at Vatican II, now we have a new Mass. No. Liturgy actually developed during those 1,500 years that they claim that there was one Mass. Now, it might have developed at a more slow rate, but liturgy certainly did develop. The liturgy actually always has developed, and so we shouldn't fear development in the liturgy as long as there's not a rupture with tradition. If we look at this, we can look back at sources. Now, a few of the sources that we have of ancient liturgy, the problem is you don't have missals right away. These things didn't show up till a lot later. It seems like a lot of, at least the prayers at Mass, were improvised at the very beginning. Some things always the same, like the institution narrative, this is my body, this is my blood. But other things a little bit more improvised. We have some descriptions from the early fathers of the church about blessings, things used as they were brought together. We also have some other examples. There's an example of a nun from Spain named Egeria. In the year 381, she made a pilgrimage to the Holy Land. And in that pilgrimage to the Holy Land, she recorded what she saw there in the liturgies. Sometimes she recorded what was different. Then she would say, and everything else is the same that we do it back home. And for us as the scholars, we're like, what? Tell us, what did you do back home? But it's amazing, especially she records the Holy Week liturgy. I did a paper on her writings on Good Friday, and it's amazing because it looks really almost exactly like our Good Friday liturgy as we celebrate it today. The Gospel of John is read, there is veneration of a relic of the true cross, and there is communion. There's no communion. I don't think there's communion. But the long prayers of the faithful, it's a really wonderful thing. I highly recommend it. We also finally have old sacramentaries. These start showing up. These are collections of prayers. We'll get into what a sacramentary is tomorrow. But old collections of prayers started showing up in the year 400 or 500. Also, we have collections of rubrics. We have a description of a papal mass from about the year 700, which is very, very helpful. And in the year 700, we finally get more fully formed missals, but they're not as complete as we have now. Now, I'm going to give you a really sort of drive-by history of sort of the major reforms in the last sort of 5 minutes I've got left in the tonight, and then I'll ask if there are any questions. But the early liturgy, like I said, seems to be quasi-improvisatory. There were certain elements that were always maintained, though. In about the year 300, the Roman canon of the Mass, or Eucharistic, what we call Eucharistic Prayer 1, I'll talk about that more tomorrow, sort of comes into existence and seems to be codified from earlier materials in Rome. The liturgy in Rome at this point in the 300s was in Greek, and then it became bilingual, and eventually it became all in Latin from about the 500s on. But in Rome, there was a big Greek community, and the liturgy in Rome actually stayed bilingual even when the rest of the Europe went to Latin. It seems that most dioceses in the Western Europe celebrated a Mass that was similar to that which was celebrated in Rome, but with some differences. These differences often included the prayers, and different parts of like the Eucharistic prayer might be movable around, things like this. We'll talk about a little bit of that tomorrow, too. So similar liturgy, but different seemed like from diocese to diocese all throughout Western Europe, with sort of a kind of a unified sense that it was unified to Rome. Now, in the year 800, something important happens in the history of Western Europe. What happens in the year 800? Does anybody remember? Charlemagne, very good. Charlemagne is crowned Holy Roman Emperor. Okay, he unifies the Frankish tribes, and the Pope gives him this title of Emperor of the Romans. And he wants to unify his kingdom. And one of the ways he wants to do it is by having a unified liturgy. And he says, now that I am the Roman Emperor, I want to emphasize a Roman liturgy on my realm. So he writes to the Pope and says, send me a sacramentary. The Pope, not knowing that he wants to send him a unified liturgy, tells one of his priests, go to the library and get a sacramentary. So they go, they get a beautiful book, and they send it up to Aachen, where Charlemagne was king. He gets the sacramentary and opens it up and finds, oh, this is only a sacramentary for part of the year, because it was for the papal liturgy, for the solemn high feasts, for the big feast of the liturgical year. But for the more ordinary days, they had a separate book. Charlemagne didn't know that. So he called his scholars together, and one of them, a man named St. Benedict of Agnes, he said, this book is not done. You finish it. So St. Benedict of Agnes said, okay, I'll fill in the missing feast days. He went around through France, and he gathered from different sources masses for the days that were missing, and there were a couple that were still missing, so he composed a few too. So you have this kind of mixed sacramentary of Roman rite and these kind of Frankish rites, and this is what they're using with Charlemagne's empire. In the 900s, Rome is a mess. About 150 years later, Rome is a mess politically, and the Emperor Otto of the Holy Roman Empire decides he's going to reimpose order on Rome. He sends his troops down, they impose order on Rome, and they get there, and they find Rome is so silly that they're not even using their proper book, because they thought they were using the Roman Rite, correct? This mixed book of Charlemagne. He brings that book down and imposes it on Rome. And that is, so this kind of mixed liturgy, developed liturgy in the 900s, comes to Rome. This book, more or less, gets revised here and there and becomes the liturgy that is used in Rome. And eventually, in the 1400s, the invention of a printing press comes along, and a Roman Missal is printed in the year 1474. This is a very important thing. This same Missal is that Missal that was the mixed Frankish-Roman Missal, and it was affirmed with a few revisions by the Council of Trent and published in the year 1570. And at this point, it was imposed over most of Europe. Now, a caveat. When Charlemagne was imposing this missal on his empire, remember, Charlemagne didn't rule all of Europe. There were a lot of dioceses that were outside of that. And even though he was imposing it, there were still other dioceses and bishops who dragged their feet about imposing it. So even though you had a semblance of unity over Western Europe, there were still a lot of variants from diocese diocese. In the Middle Ages, these two new orders appear, Franciscans and Dominicans. And there's a problem because they're moving around. They're itinerants, right? So St. Dominic tells his brothers, okay, look, you can't be learning a new mass every time you go into a different diocese to preach. It'd be like I would have to learn a new mass and when I come here to celebrate in the Diocese of Birmingham and then go home and it's a different mass in Washington than in California. It'd be a mess. So they developed what we called the Dominican Rite, a unified liturgy. And St. Dominic actually had, and his successors, they copied this rite in Rome, and they copied it to like 10 or 15 books, and they sent these books throughout Europe to the rest of the order. And the rest of the order copied from these books. And so we had a unified rite early on that we celebrated wherever we went to go preach. The Franciscans decided they were very humble, and they decided we will just take what the Pope does. And so they took the Roman liturgy that the Pope was using at the time and imposed that on the Franciscan order that was used everywhere. And they're very, very similar, especially at this time. Council of Trent comes along, 1570, imposes this revised Roman Missal on all of Europe with a few exceptions. And these are actually kind of important to realize that there are places where the liturgy is slightly different in Europe, even after the Council of Trent. The Mozarabic Rite in Toledo, Spain. There was a Spanish rite which persevered there. In the Archdiocese of Milan in Italy, a rite called the Ambrosian Rite was celebrated. Many local dioceses in France had their own variants. There were monastic rites such as the Carthusian Rite, and of course the Dominicans were allowed to maintain their liturgy after Trent. So we never celebrated the Tridentine liturgy. We never celebrated what many people call the traditional Latin Mass, We celebrated a Mass that was older, and we still do this. Whenever Dominicans celebrate the extraordinary form, we normally celebrate this Dominican rite, which is actually a medieval form of the Mass. It's older than the Tridentine version. In 1962, Pope John XXIII, in preparation for Vatican II, issued a slight revision of the Tridentine Missal. And, of course, the big revision after Vatican II, and the allowance of the vernacular on a wide use with the Vatican II liturgy. We'll go through the Vatican II liturgy, but I wanted to just kind of walk through really fast all of the history. Now, I gave you what's usually about two semesters worth of work in grad school in about 45 minutes. So, sorry about that. I threw a lot of information at you. You don't have to know this as much. I just give this as sort of a brief historical context before we go into the Mass in a lot greater detail. But any questions about any of this stuff that I said? Yes?
You were talking about the older version and all of these revisions, mm-hmm. all these different areas. Mm-hmm. Were they spoken in the vernacular, or was it only in Rome that it was in Latin?
They were spoken in Latin. They were spoken in Latin.
Older, like you say, the Benedictines never changed.
Yes, always in Latin.
It was always in Latin.
Yes.
So now that we're going into the norm is to have
in the vernacular.
Sanctus, the Agnus Dei in Latin, and the rest of the Mass in English. Mm-hmm. Is that going to be our new norm, or are we going to be going totally Latin? And my only concern is because our kids, I know I grew up learning Latin,
mm-hmm.
and so I know what I'm saying. But our kids didn't grow that way. And so that just...
Yeah, the norm that the church says now... So first of all, two parts of your question. The first thing is, remember the liturgy started in Greek and eventually evolved into Latin. And it remained in Greek in the Eastern Church and eventually would go into some of the more older versions of the vernacular and some of the other Eastern rites. There were some vernacularizations before the Council of Trent and even after. But you're asking about after Vatican II. No, I don't think there's any, that I know of, move by the Sacred Congregation to impose a new norm. The norm is now that you can use Latin or you could use the vernacular or you can use a mixture. And so I think that a lot of people are recovering more of a mixture, but I don't get the sense that in general, people are trying to impose only Latin. I know that some people might call for that. I love Latin. I celebrate Mass in Latin. If it's called for, if people want it, I'll celebrate it in Latin, celebrate it in English, celebrate it in Portuguese, celebrate it in Spanish. Those are the languages I can do fairly well.
And Gregorian chant, I think it's beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And one of our priests in our parish wanted to bring it back mm-hmm. to our parish. And there were some people who were really taken offense to that.
Yeah.
And I think it's based on the fact that we really don't know what we speak.
Hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because we don't know our history and mm-hmm. how that was, that we really didn't know that we should be doing.
I think there might be a fear too that some people, because the liturgy was enforced in Latin, and I think some people, especially older people, I know my mom's generation and older, tend to get worried about that sometimes, that like don't impose completely Latin. But I do think there are a lot of people who like the Latin, but again, I don't think that's going to be... Yes, other questions?
The host.
Yes.
It's supposed to be made out of wheat.
Correct, wheat.
What about these gluten-free hosts?
So gluten-free host is not completely gluten-free. It has a tiny smidgen of gluten in it. Yeah, it's very super low gluten. But it has to have at least a little bit. Somebody who's completely allergic to gluten, we had actually a girl at the Newman Center in Tucson, and she was so allergic that even the little bit would cause her to act up. We actually just gave her a little bit of the precious blood. Other questions? Yes?
You mentioned that the Dominicans have the oldest versions of
the Mass. An older diversion, yes. Yeah.
What did they say
those older versions? Always. Oh, now you mean, or?
Sure. It's the same Mass.
Correct. Okay, so the Dominicans had a rite that was developed in the Middle Ages, and so it was a little bit simpler, actually, than the Mass that came after Trent. If you're familiar with the older Mass at all, or the older form of the Mass, the extraordinary form, there's something called the prayers at the foot of the altar, which are sort of more elaborate prayers that the priest and the servers do down before they come up to the altar. The Dominicans didn't have that. It was a very, very quick little prayer that they said at the beginning. Also, we didn't have something called the last gospel. In the older form of the Mass, at the very end of the Mass, the priest recites the gospel, the very beginning of the Gospel of St. John. He recites it over on the left side of the altar. Originally, that was something the priest said in private when he was going back to the sacristy, and that's as kind of his own private devotion, and it got put into the Mass. But it got put into the Mass after the Dominicans got going, so we never did it. Now, later bishops tried to enforce it on us, and we would do it, but what we would do is we'd put out the candles while it was going on. It's kind of a protest, like, well, we'll do this, but the Mass is really over. So those are some of the small differences. There's another thing that the chalice is prepared earlier. It's not prepared at the offertory. It's prepared between the readings, actually. So it's prepared. So it used to be Dominican priests, when they would go into other parishes to give missions, would be done with the first reading, and they would say to the priest, to the altar boy, water and wine. And they'll say, no, Father, that comes later. He says, no, it comes now, right now. Just don't worry, just bring it up. Okay. And so there are a few differences like that, but it looks a lot the same. We still celebrate it. We always have celebrated it in the West for special occasions. And now, like I said, with especially the motu proprio and the rise in popularity of the older form of the Mass, when Dominicans do it, we tend to celebrate it in the Dominican Rite, so the older medieval rite. And a lot of our younger seminarians and priests are learning how to do that. I personally have never celebrated it, but I know how to do it. And so if an occasion arose for people who wanted to have that, I would do it.
So you celebrate that mostly among yourselves, the friars, mm-hmm. not really in congregations?
Oh, no, we celebrated in congregations. Mm-hmm. We celebrated it everywhere before 1968. The Dominicans did, yeah.
But anymore?
Yeah, we do, mostly in our parishes. In Dominican parishes. So like I know that on the Feast of St. Dominic coming up here August the 8th, a number of parishes across the country, Dominican parishes, are celebrating it as a special witness for St. Dominic. Yeah, that's a good question. If you Google Dominican liturgy, you will get a wonderful blog spot run by one of the priests of my province, Father Augustine Thompson, and he has all sorts of information, including books about it, including online resources. You don't even have to buy the book. You can just download the PDF. It's online. So if you Google Dominican liturgy, you will get this great website with regard to this. And he also includes in it where it's being celebrated around the country. So if you happen to be at a place where it's being celebrated, like I said, I know on August 8th, a lot of places are celebrating it. Oh, it was in Latin, yeah.
Oh, when you say celebrated,
when we use the term Dominican Rite, that refers to the old form of the Mass that the Dominicans did before 1968, which is that medieval liturgy. Yeah, and it's in Latin. It's facing the same direction that the people facing this way. The whole shebang. It looks a lot like what people call the Trinitarian Mass, but it's actually slightly different. People who are connoisseurs of the Tridentine Mass, who are ignorant of the Dominican customs, they actually get mad at us sometimes. We say, actually, we got the older tradition. Ha ha. So it is, yeah, it's a Latin liturgy. It's a very beautiful liturgy if you ever get to see it. It really, really is. It's absolutely stunning. So two more questions. And yeah. Oh, sure, go ahead.
I've asked about three times to participate, at least in the Eastern Rite.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. The liturgy is profoundly beautiful.
Yeah, yeah.
Incredible. That was the first time, kind of blew me away.
So one of the videos, what Hector is bringing up is the fact that there are other Catholic liturgies, right, that are not Roman, that they're Eastern Catholic liturgies. And they're absolutely profound, and they're very different. We're not going to be going through those because that would be a whole different sort of area. But one of the videos I'm going to show you of to start one of the talks will be from Eastern liturgy, from a Russian liturgy. By the way, there's another Western liturgy now approved, since you're all taking notes on this, that's approved to be used, and it's in English. That's the Anglican use. I don't know if anybody's ever heard of this. The Anglican use is for use for Episcopalians who have become Catholics, and they're allowed to retain their liturgy. And I, because my dad was an Episcopalian, I actually know how that liturgy goes. So I have faculties to use that as is needed. And I've used it in Washington, D.C. We've had about 5 or 6 parishes of the Episcopal Church that have come into the Catholic Church. And while their priests are getting ready to be ordained Catholic priests, I've gone in and helped in that transitional period celebrating Mass for them. And so I know how to do that liturgy. It's beautiful. It's in English, and it looks a lot like ours, but they say thee, thy, and thou a lot. And so, but it's very, very beautiful too. If you ever had the chance to participate in that liturgy, it fulfills Catholic obligation. Anybody can go to it. And it's in English. So it's another option, sort of very diverse. The priest does need faculties to do it, yeah, because it's for a specialized reason to do that, so it just can't be just sort of whenever. So they have to apply to the Anglican Ordinariate in the United States, which is headed up by Monsignor Stenson. And so that's they gave me the faculties to use them as needed.
Now that's all pretty new.
That's fairly new. This is since 2009. The liturgy was around before that, but it's been revised, and it's absolutely stunning. In fact, their marriage rite just came through. And so this is all stuff that's very new. And again, it fulfills Catholic obligation. So thank you. I know that this, now I'm talking a lot about the older stuff today. I'm going to be talking about the history throughout the weekend, but it's going to be mainly in the context of what the liturgy is like now. I'm happy to always to talk about the history because I love the history. But I really do want to, because the vast majority of us, right, we go to just Roman rite vernacular liturgy. And so that's mainly what I'm going to be hitting at, is what is behind this. But it will go into necessarily these other areas to say, well, the Eastern Church might do this, or the Anglicans do this, or something like that. But or the Dominicans used to do this, and we still do it with our Dominican rite. So anyway, we hope to do this so that we can understand the Mass better, and we can get more of the fruits of the Mass now, but also that we can grow in holiness. Let us pray. Lord, we give you thanks and praise for the gift of the holy sacrifice of the Mass, and we ask you to bless us this evening. We ask this in the name of your Son, and we pray as he taught us. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Amen. Our help is in the name of the Lord, who made heaven and earth.